The Guardian wrote that there are hospital operating theatres that have to close when it rains too hard. A downpour causes leaks that could trigger an electrical fault in vital machinery keeping a patient alive. Parts of the NHS, they say, are crumbling. Badly needed repairs across the estate have been costed at £6 billion. Hospital trusts have not been able to put their houses in order for years. Capital spending in the NHS has been severely squeezed, they say. And they conclude that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's £1.8 billion for the NHS will do little to fix Britain's crumbling hospitals. Now, last year, we celebrated the NHS's 70th birthday, and it was showered with praise. But is it justifiable praise? And do The Guardian actually have a point here? Is this system, that is an international laggard in many key measures, including health outcomes, survival rates, and waiting times? Whilst cash injections may indeed help in the short term, and there might well be an argument to spend more money on healthcare, will they prove to be a waste of taxpayers' money if structural changes aren't made alongside this investment? Additionally, as the UK leaves the EU, there are some that argue that the NHS might well be on the table in negotiations over a future US-UK trade deal. And is the NHS ready for a no-deal Brexit? I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and joining me to discuss is the IEA's Head of Political Economy, Christian Niemitz, and the IEA's Economics Fellow, Julian Jessop. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Christian, in The Telegraph earlier this week, you argue that change is basically impossible whilst we pretend that there are only two healthcare systems in the world, namely the NHS and the US system. I wonder if you can explain what you mean by this and what is actually the difference between these two systems?
Okay, well, there are, broadly speaking, three types of healthcare models. You can have a national or regional, a state-funded, state-provided healthcare service, that's the NHS, or in other countries you get regionalized versions of that. By the way, that would be a model in which the state pays for most healthcare and it also directly provides that healthcare, an integrated service. Then there are systems of public insurance where you have a state funder, a state organization, a state health insurer that pays for most healthcare, but it doesn't necessarily provide it. It buys that healthcare in a competitive market. So that would be a system like in France. Then there are multi-payer systems where you have competing health insurers and competing healthcare providers. That's also a fairly common model. That's the model that you get in the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany, Belgium, Israel, and you get it as a top-up system in many other places. The US, or at least for the working age population, also falls into that category, but it's just within that category a very unusual system, completely uncomparable to any other. So it really doesn't make much sense to single out that system, especially since that's the only system in the developed world that's that doesn't offer universal access in all of those other multi-payer systems. You have the government still makes sure that everybody has health insurance, so they are universal systems, and insurers cannot refuse to cover, for example, pre-existing conditions. They have to cover everyone and everything, and so universality can absolutely be guaranteed in multi-payer systems. It's just the US system that doesn't do that. And that's one of the many things that make this system so atypical. I just think it's a waste of time to even focus on that system. There's no one in the country who says we should adopt that system. And even if somebody did want to do that, I don't even know how you would do it, given that it is such an unusual system. It's really in a category of its own in just about every way.
And possibly because it just is quite bad, really, at doing.
Yes, that's the reason why people bring it up. Yeah. Opponents of healthcare reform more broadly, or just talking about possible alternatives, bring it up because it's an easy way to score points. Pick out the worst system that you can possibly find. They wouldn't say, "Oh, you want a system like in the Netherlands? How awful would that be?" Because it clearly wouldn't be awful.
Why do you think that healthcare outcomes and measures of health system efficiency are actually a hell of a lot better in the Netherlands. Why is that system so much more desirable, in your opinion, to the NHS?
I think broadly for the same reason that competitive mechanisms, market mechanisms, generally mean superior outcomes to a monopoly provider. And healthcare, we're always told healthcare is not like any other sector. You can't compare it to anything else. Well, I don't think that's true. I think some of the same mechanisms are still the same. It's not, healthcare is not a sector that exists somewhere outside of the economy, outside of the laws of supply and demand. We still need market mechanisms to find the best way of doing things. We need trial and error, and we need competitive pressure to learn from the best performers. That is something that you definitely get in the Netherlands. There, health insurers can contract selectively. If there is a healthcare provider that isn't up to scratch, that underperforms, they can lose contracts. There would be a strong incentive for them to look at what the better ones are doing differently and learn from them. And healthcare providers can also be shut down and taken over by superior providers, which of course can happen here as well. But here it would be a political decision. It would be the minister making a decision like that, whereas there that would be a market outcome.
And then you mentioned in your Telegraph piece that in the early to mid 2000s, there was an appetite for greater public spending on the NHS. So the budget increased by more than 6% after inflation each year. And then in the beginning of this decade, the political emphasis shifted towards fiscal consolidation. So for a couple of years, the NHS budget barely increased at all. Now, do you think it's right then to argue that this could be blame for the system's current woes, that there just hasn't been the money going into the system?
That depends on what we're talking about. For example, last winter, the winter crisis, I mean, there's a winter crisis of sorts every year, but this year it's been unusually severe. That you can blame on changes in funding, and also the fact that key waiting times, waiting time targets have been broken. That probably is caused by the slowdown in spending. So it has made the system even worse than it was before. So the difference between the situation now and the difference in, say, 2010, that you can attribute to changes in funding. But 2010 or the early 2000s were hardly a golden age. The NHS has always been a laggard in many ways. It's just that those are things that we don't normally talk about because we don't directly experience them. When waiting times go up, we notice it. That's what makes newspaper articles, or when performance at A&E is particularly terrible. But the fact that survival rates for key conditions are lower here than in many comparable countries, that's not something that you directly experience. So therefore, that doesn't make the headlines. But in the long term, those things, those long-term performance measures are actually more important than short-term fluctuations in waiting time targets.
So will this spending make any difference whatsoever then?
I think it will. On things like waiting times, especially in A&E, and things like the winter crisis, things that where money can make a difference in the short term, yes, it will. But there is a broader problem, of course, that you get this constant alternation between feast and famine. You get years of very large spending injections. In the Blair years, over 6% every year. In one year, it was more than 10%. And then in the early Cameron years, you had 0 point something increases. You get this massive fluctuation, and it's always determined by political priorities. That is an issue, and that only happens in a system or in systems of this type, in which everything that happens in the healthcare sector is politically controlled. That the Dutch health minister just wouldn't have that power. They don't set the healthcare budget. That would be driven by decisions on the ground, the type of healthcare plan that people sign up for, and the premiums that health insurers want to set. Of course, politics makes a difference. The Dutch health minister could oblige health insurers to cover a treatment that they're not currently covering. They can indirectly try to influence it, but not in the sense that they would say, this year, an extra 2 billion. They don't have the power to do that.
So you pick up a Dutch newspaper and it never says that there are only 24 hours to save their healthcare system. Okay. Right, Julian, I want to turn to you now. Now, so if you do a quick search on Twitter, you'll see many popular hashtags around the NHS. They'll say things like, the Americans want our NHS. They'll say, people before profits. NHS is not for sale. Do you think concerns about the impact of a US-UK trade deal on the NHS are justified?
Well, I think that, like many of the scare stories around around Brexit and any relationship with the US in particular, I think those stories are overdone. It's difficult to know where to start with this story, though, because it's very difficult to pin down exactly what it is that people are worried about or supposed to be worried about. For example, if you do a trade deal with another country, that there's nothing in that that obliges you to adopt their healthcare model. After all, we have a free trade deal at the moment with the rest of the European Union, but there's a wide diversity of healthcare models within the European Union, and interestingly, nobody's chosen to adopt the UK version. So simply having a trade deal with someone doesn't oblige you to adopt their model of healthcare or finance. There are a few things that might change in principle. It's possible that more American companies will be able to bid for public sector contracts, including NHS contracts, than they can now. Although it's already the case that lots of American companies supply goods and services to the NHS, and I'd argue that's a good thing. It increases competition and improves quality and drives down prices. It's possible that Americans might put pressure on the UK to start paying higher prices for drugs, but basically these prices are set in the market. Free trade agreements don't specify the prices that you pay for goods and services. I think the most likely outcome is that if we do get a free trade deal with the US, some aspects of the NHS might be open to more competition, but the most sensitive areas could still be ring-fenced. That's another important feature of any free trade deal. It's usual to carve out certain public services. If we wanted to carve out some of the NHS, we could do so. I personally think that would be a mistake, but if that's the way that a government wants to go, then fair enough.
And of course, opening up markets on things like pharmaceuticals or indeed NHS equipment, that could mean better value for British taxpayers, couldn't it?
Well, you'd have thought so. I mean, generally, these are the reasons why we like free trade. It seems very odd to say that, you know, we like free trade with the rest of Europe, but we don't like free trade with the US. I mean, there are plenty of European companies supplying goods and services to the NHS. Why would we say that they are free to do so, whereas a US company can't? As it happens, by the way, there are some very big contracts in the NHS that are already accessed by US companies. IBM, for example, runs a lot of the IT systems of the NHS. Nobody seems to have a big problem with that. It comes back to this idea that Christian was touching on earlier, sort of the idea that there's sort of contagion from the US healthcare model to how we might do things in the UK just because we've got a trade deal with them. And that's simply not how trade deals work. And it's not what the economics and the politics of this are going to be either. You know, we will be under no greater pressure to adopt the US healthcare model than we are now to adopt the healthcare model of any other European country, where frankly, actually, the healthcare is often a lot better.
And Julian, as well as announcing this $1.8 billion for the NHS, it seems more likely than it possibly ever has been since June 23rd, 2016, that this country will leave with a no-deal Brexit. Do you think the NHS is ready for that? Because you hear so many whispers about there are fears of medicine shortages and hospital bed build-ups. Do you think these concerns are justifiable?
Well, again, I mean, you need to dig past the headlines to try and identify exactly what it is that people are afraid of. I've heard two concerns in particular. One you've mentioned, which is the medicines shortfall. But if people are really worried that it's going to be harder for us to import medicines from the EU than would otherwise have been the case, that's not actually telling you a great deal about either our own ability to deal with potential supply disruptions or indeed the attitude of the EU. I mean, would the EU really refuse to sell us life-saving medicines just because we're no longer a member of their political union? I mean, I think it's pretty extreme. if there are going to be any disruptions here, this is surely an area also where contingency plans will be very straightforward to organise. I mean, you could easily, you know, fast track medicines through customs or fly them in or whatever else is that you need to do. So I think that the medicine story is overdone. The other perennial favourite is staff shortages. Now, of course, there have been staff shortages in the US and in the NHS pretty much since the dawn of time for various reasons. It has been suggested it will be harder to recruit or attract people from the rest of the EU. There might be a legitimate concern there, actually. I think the government's approach to migration over the last few years in particular has been pretty poor. It's not been anywhere near as welcoming and open as those of us who believe in free markets and mobility of labour would like. But again, that essentially is a decision that rests in the UK government's hands. I think under any future migration policy, you'd want to prioritise people who are delivering essential health and social care services. And worth stressing, of course, also that the rest of the EU is not the only place that we can get healthcare workers from. There has been a slowdown in the number of people coming from the EU to the UK since the referendum, but it's largely been offset by an increase in people coming from the rest of the world. So there's undoubtedly a potential problem there, but it is solvable with the right and, I think, sensibly liberal policy on migration after Brexit.
And then also this week, the Health Secretary announced plans to reform our tax system that deters senior medics from taking on extra shifts. Seen stories about NHS cancer scans that have been left unread for weeks because of this pension row, with hospitals cutting services as consultants stop doing overtime to avoid these huge tax bills. Can you explain what this was, Julian, and why it's a good thing, you believe it's a good thing that the Health Secretary has announced this?
Well, this is a very timely example, I think, of the so-called Laffer curve in action. You know, the idea that beyond a certain level, tax rates actually can be too high. They actually produce lower revenues because they discourage people from working. In this case, there's a double whammy. You know, not only are consultants not working and not paying tax because otherwise their pension contributions would get so high that they hit with a much bigger bill. So not only is the exchequer suffering, but in this case, even worse than that, patients are suffering. So you have a crazy system where tax rates are set at such a high level that not only is the exchequer losing revenue that it would otherwise gain, but also people who use public services, in this case directly, are suffering from the consequences. So I think it's absolutely right that the government is finally addressing this, but hopefully we'll draw the lesson for the tax system as a whole, that high tax rates don't necessarily raise more money or help in any way to deliver the public services that we all want.
Right. Now, Christian, it's not really in my gift, but let's say I'm Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and I decide to make Christian Neimitz Health Secretary, sending Twitter into a fit. There's quite clearly a sort of demographic time bomb in this country that's ready to blow. As folk live longer and demands on the NHS increase, what do you think you would do as Health Secretary to ensure that the NHS is ready for that time bomb to explode?
That, unfortunately, is a problem that is common to all healthcare systems. There is none. Switching to a different healthcare system would solve many problems, especially in terms of performance, but the demographic problems and the problems of long-term financing would remain exactly the same. The only thing that you can really do here is building up old age reserves in time. There is no system that does that across the board, but there are some health insurers in Germany which are obliged to do that. They cover about 8 million people. What they do is they try to keep the premiums that you pay constant throughout a lifetime. That means that when you're young, your premiums are much higher than your actual healthcare costs. And the reason for that is that they put that money into an old age reserve fund. And as you get older, they use that money to keep your premium flat. And that is the way that they make that system resistant to demographic changes. And that means as when a society grows older, then this old age pot would grow alongside it. So ideally, the way I would do it is if we had a competitive system, I would want every health insurer to build up old age reserves in that way. And then you would have a comfortable buffer.
Which we'll surely have to. I mean, you know, this is getting quite serious already, isn't it?
Yes, but I'm afraid you can't really do it in a system like ours. You could have, in principle, a sovereign wealth fund tied to the NHS somehow. I guess the closest thing here would be the Norwegian oil wealth fund. They use that to effectively pre-fund their pension system. If you have a fund like that, then that can work. But of course, ideally, we would have started ages ago building up a fund like that. And then there are also problems that if you have a single healthcare provider, then that would be in a single healthcare financing agency. You would have a state monopoly building up that old age fund, that sovereign wealth fund, and there would be a danger that it would get politicized. You would have all sorts of pressure groups saying, invest in this industry, but not in that one. Divest from fossil fuel companies, put it all into renewable energy. And that's an issue which you don't have, or at least not to the same extent, if you have competing insurers and they can all invest that more or less the way they see fit.
Julian, I make you health secretary, the hardest job possibly in cabinet. What is it that you do?
Well, I think we need a fundamental rethink about the way we provide and finance healthcare in this country. I'm often asked the question, you know, how much money is enough for the NHS? And I think that problem is essentially unanswerable. If you're providing any good or service for nothing at the point of use, then demand is potentially unlimited, and particularly, of course, with all the medical advances and people living longer, I think potentially the NHS is a bottomless pit. There are basically three things that I would think about changing, and one is I think that those people who can afford to pay more for their healthcare directly should pay more. We've already, of course, dipped our toe in the water here. For example, people in England who can afford to do so do pay prescription charges. So that's not a red line. But I think those people who can afford to pay more directly should be expected to do so. I think we need more competition in the provision of healthcare to make it much easier for people to choose which hospital they go to. So that's putting more choice in the hands of the consumer, which we know is generally a good thing. And finally, I think we need more diversity in funding models, you know, rather than the bulk of people relying on paying into an imaginary national insurance fund to pay for their healthcare. There should be private sector alternatives, undoubtedly topped up if necessary for poor people. We want to clearly maintain the principle of universal access to healthcare, regardless of your ability to pay. But that doesn't prevent the fact that those people who can pay, I think, should pay, and probably pay a bit more to make sure that they're valuing health services properly and that resources are allocated to the places where there is genuinely the most demand.
Yeah, can I just add one point to that? I mean, most other systems have co-payments already, that's well established elsewhere, and they all have some mechanisms to make sure that if you're poor, that doesn't deter your access. There's lots of ways in which you can do that. You can do it directly on a means-tested basis, saying that if you're unemployed, you're automatically exempt, or you can have an annual cap. Once you reach a certain level, you don't need to pay anymore. That cap can be set as a proportion of income. There's lots of ways in which you can do that and keep the system equitable. That really isn't the issue. So this is another one of those irrational fears. There is the belief, I think, that if you introduce this even on a very minor level, it would become a slippery slope. It would become the thin end of a wedge where in the beginning it's just £5, but then after a couple of years it gets more and more. But then that has never happened anywhere as far as I'm aware. In systems that have co-payments already, every increase in co-payments is always a controversial decision. It's not that leads to a situation where where you get a ratchet effect where it automatically increases. It's more that whatever level of copayment you have, that becomes the norm. If you want to increase it further, that remains a controversial thing in its own right. And there are examples of countries introducing particular copayments and then abolishing them again in response to political pressure. So there really is no slippery slope effect here.
What do you at home think? Does the NHS need reform to fix its ails? Or is the solution yet another cash injection? Let us know at IEA London. You can subscribe to this podcast from wherever it is that you get your podcast. For IEA films and reports, head to our website, iea.org.uk. See you next week.